everyone, and welcome back to the I Need to Effing Talk to You podcast. I am your co-host, Ken Cameron, and it's my great pleasure to have as our guest on the podcast today, a very special guest. We have our regular co-host, Russell Stratton, in the guest interviewee seat today. So, Russell, welcome to the podcast as a guest.
Well, thank you for welcoming me to the regular position of the podcast, but as a guest. And I think this is because we don't have anybody to effing interview this time. So it's sort of, Russ is going to pretend to be the interviewee and be interviewed by Ken. So it's the best we could do for you folks. That's what it was.
And so we just kind of, as in the Wizard of Oz, please, listener, pay no attention to what's going on behind the curtain that Russell just revealed when he parted the backstage curtain there. We're just going to let that curtain fall, and we're going to pretend that Russell is our regular guest today. But in all seriousness, the reason we've asked Russell on in the guest position, and I'm going to assume the host of the questioner position, is because we want to talk to Russell about a model that Russell encountered while he was working with colleagues at Scotland Yard. And now in my imagination, I've got a picture of Russell working at Scotland Yard, wearing his tweed coat and wearing his deerstalker cap with his crooked pipe, looking for all the world like Sherlock Holmes, peering at evidence through his magnifying glass and working with some rough and tumble bobbies who are in their black uniforms with their pointed conehead caps and speaking in their strong East End accents as they go out in those horse-drawn carriages to try to track down those nefarious criminals in London's Victorian underworld. But I feel as if the reality isn't quite like that, because I think that, Russell, by the time you went to work at Scotland Yard, it was a little more modernized than that, and your contemporaries weren't so much the Sherlock Holmes and the Hercule Poirots of the Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie's, but something more modern. So maybe, Russell, why don't you correct the listener's image of what it was really like working there?
Well, it was exactly as you described, Ken, apart from the pipe. Simply because they had a no-smoking policy at that time. Otherwise, everything was exactly the same. I often wore a deerstalker hat and wandered around in a tweed jacket with a large magnifying glass. And while they were going off to send off their indomitable bobbies to catch those Victorian criminals in the underworld in the East End. The nefarious criminals.
So when you say you were a consultant, yeah. So when you say you were a consultant, you really were a consulting detective, just like in Sherlock.
I'd like to say I was, and I was some sort of Robert Downey Jr. sort of type in one of those Sherlock Holmes movies, but alas, no. But I was a consultant working with the Metropolitan Police, as it's officially known, or Scotland Yard, as you always fondly refer to it as, working on secondment with them on their leadership development program with someone who's become a good friend and colleague of mine, Fergus Lawson, who is going to be a guest on our podcast as a real interviewee soon in the not too distant future. So in terms of Scotland Yard, the funny thing was I worked at Scotland Yard, but only ever visited the actual building with a little Scotland Yard rotating sign once to get my pass. And one of the things I was told when I received my pass and had my photograph taken was this was fine, but I wasn't allowed to use that pass to go into police stations at the weekend to have a breakfast. I have no idea why you'd be told everybody. It wasn't just me thinking you're going to look like a guy who's going to come and take up a free breakfast. Everyone who got their pass was told this does not mean you can go to a local police station and help yourself to a breakfast. Why they felt the need to say that, I don't know. Everyone looked rather puzzled as to why they were told this when they picked up their pass. But that was the only time I went to the actual Scotland Yard, as was seen. The offices I worked in were far less exciting and grandiose, more of a smaller building in a sort of annex a couple of streets away around the corner, which actually looked more Victorian from the outside than Scotland Yard itself. So we were probably a leftover of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson from years before.
Russell, I think my version's way cooler than you've just described here.
Yeah, if you've ever watched any Sherlock Holmes movies or the television series, there's never been any issues about people getting their pass or not being allowed to have free breakfast. So it's always way cooler the way you describe it, Ken, than the reality.
So you didn't have any Baker Street irregulars following you around that you could bribe and send the little street urchins out to spy and to find out what they would, what's going on in the London underworld or anything like that?
No, there was no Oliver Twist, no Fagin to be going around there or Bill Sykes. Nothing like that. Nothing is exciting. I mean, in reality, I mean, seriously, you know, the Metropolitan Police is the UK's largest police force. I mean, London has got a population of about 9 million people. So it's a fairly large organisation. A lot of people work for them, both in the civilian side, as I was, and also in the uniform side. And one of the things that I did get to do, which was pretty cool, is because we were working with their leadership development program, and specifically around borough commanders and the fast stream approach. So this was their sort of up-and-coming, high-profile individuals, is that I got to go and interview a number of them at a number of different police stations, which meant that I could come in there and into the hallowed halls and see some pretty high and mighty individuals without having to be sort of prostrating myself in front of them. Because I didn't actually work for the police, so I wasn't a police officer, so I wasn't in the command and control structure. I was a civilian contractor, so it allowed me some certain privileges that not everybody else enjoyed at that time.
And what was the project that you were working on? What were the goals and objectives of that project that you were working on?
The two projects. One was around the fast track leadership development program. So it was looking at what are the competencies that are required for officers moving into those senior ranks who've been through a fast track promotion system. And the second project, which relates to our topic this afternoon, the model that you referred to, was something called the Borough Commander Program that my colleague Fergus Lawson had been heavily involved in. And the Borough Commander Program was focusing on what I would say were the top cops in those regions of London. London was split into a number of boroughs, which are the same for voting purposes as they are for policing purposes and administrative purposes from a government level. And each of them has a senior police officer in charge. And this was working on development for those particular individuals, specifically in their role that was community-facing. Because I think to put it into some sort of context, this was after the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, which was the death of a black teenager who was killed at a bus stop in London. The police came under a lot of scrutiny in the investigation of that, in the fact that his assailants got away with it. They weren't put away from a criminal prosecution. There were several loopholes in the police case, and part of this was in response to ensuring that police and community relations had improved as a result of what had happened some years before and the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, which had thrown up a number of issues for the Metropolitan Police in terms of how it policed communities, particularly minority communities. So the piece of work with the Borough Commander Program is how do we better equip people who are used to have been promoted over the years and worked in a command and control structure to now work where they have to work with other agencies and communities where perhaps the traditional command and control approach, which they were very good at, isn't as successful in that different dynamic.
I see. This is particularly interesting then in today's political context, where over the past like year and a half, 2 years, we've been seeing a lot of these similar kinds of things happening down in the U.S. when it resulted in Black Lives Matter and so on. So it's interesting to hear the response that happened then. And how long ago was this, Russell? Not so that you could date yourself too much, but if you can give us just broad general terms, was this in the past few years or was this several decades ago?
Well, it was during the reign of Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II, which gives us plenty of scope because she's been on the throne for many years. This was around 2001, 2002.
Okay. All right. So that gives us a sense that this is not new news, but it's also interesting how some of these issues just kind of persisted and keep coming back in kind of cycles or waves. And what these borough commanders learned was, as you say, they're used to this command and control structure. They're used to working internally within the department and within their borough, but now suddenly they have to go out into the community. And this program was about equipping them to speak to the community members.
Yeah, and just understanding that there was all about how they would influence. And one of the things, I'm going to give one example of how this would manifest itself, is that in a typical command and control structure where you have, you know, a senior manager and a middle manager and then perhaps a group of employees, you know, that command and control, I tell you, Ken, this is what I need you to do. You tell your team that's what they need to do. And they have to do it because they work for you, you work for me, and as long as it's ethical and legal, it's a management request. Well, of course, once you move outside of an organization where people either don't work for your organization, perhaps we're talking about social services or another law enforcement agency like Customs and Excise, or one of the local government agencies. And then you go the other side to think about, well, the community and community members, then you can't enforce what you want somebody to do when they don't work, not just don't work for you, they don't work for your organization either. And from a community perspective, you know, arriving in uniform was an immediate turnoff for a number of people. So what a couple of borough commanders found when I was talking to them is they had a completely different result from going to a community meeting that was perhaps talking about concerns in the community, which were around high crime rates and vandalism and knife crime and things like this. If they turned up in their police uniform, they might find that two people spoke to them. If they turned up more casually attired, still everybody knowing who they were, just simply by not wearing a uniform, suddenly they were getting 10, 12, 15 people come and talk to them. So it was, how could they remove barriers that made it easier for people to talk to them, to approach them, to build trust, and be able to communicate effectively so that they could do what their job was, which was policing the community and keeping people safe, and for the community to get what they wanted, which was to live in a safe community. So the outcome was, you know, for both groups was very similar. It was just how you got there, and this was trying to find ways to avoid putting barriers in place that were going to, you know, get in the way rather than help.
So, Russell, some of what you described seems ridiculously self-evident. Like, it seems to me that if you're a police officer and you're in this kind of social context that you've described following this kind of inquiry, and it's not hard for our listeners or myself to imagine what that might be like, because as I said, so much of it's in the news these days. So it seems self-evident that if I'm like a police chief or leadership in the police community, and I want to go into a diverse community that has been having high crime rates, and I want to be approachable, then don't wear my uniform. Seems self-evident, right? So why is this news?
Well, and that was just one example of it. There was a sort of obvious visual example. But it wasn't so. I mean, one, you're talking about it's 20 years ago. So what people would have thought 20 years ago to be as against what they think now would be slightly different. The other thing to think about is that's what had always been expected of the police, that they would be in uniform when they were, unless they were obviously working in undercover or plain clothes, but, you know, they would be in uniform if they were representing the police in an official capacity. So it was more about a structure and a form and a way of doing things, a culture that was there, which had been there for, you know, 50, 100 years, that was just finding that that was perhaps not being as helpful as it had been in the past. And one thing to point out with the borough commanders, and sometimes when I've spoken about this, that people are, oh, well, so, you know, they weren't particularly bright or they somehow didn't understand this. The reality is that that's not the case. You know, these were incredibly bright men and women who themselves came from a diverse background, you know, they understood this very well, and they took to this very well. What this was trying to do was to formalize some tools and techniques based upon their feedback as well as feedback from others as to what would be the best way to set people up for success. So some of it was lessons learned. And the idea about the not wearing uniform was a couple of commanders themselves who said, this really worked for me. And then saying to a colleague, why don't you try that if you're saying it's difficult to have connection with this particular group of people? So I want to get that clear. These were, in the main, very bright, very able individuals who had a desire to move things forward as an organization. They weren't a sort of group of Luddites who are being dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
Right. Thank you. I'm glad you clarified that point as well. But I also find it interesting that you've described something that, like, it seems that so often that the usual way of doing things overrides common sense, right? Or overrides, hey, we know we want to have this outcome, but I always have to show up in my uniform because that's the way it always is. It's interesting how the usual way of doing things has to be disrupted and how hard that can be for even the most intelligent among us, as you pointed out.
Exactly. And also the fact that we have to remember when we're talking about something that happened in the past, that we don't slip into that like history of now. You know, because we know that now doesn't necessarily mean that it was obvious to people 20 years ago. And it's the same with other things. You know, go back 50 years and say, well, how did people behave? Why did they behave in that way? Why did they do those things? It seems so obvious to us now that that wasn't the way to approach things. But of course, at the time, it was perhaps, you know, newer. They were testing some of these concepts out. And as I say, you know, the wearing and not wearing a uniform was just one small element of a broader piece of work which came into the whole idea about how do we influence outside of a structure that we that people are not part of our organizational structure. That was the really sort of key piece that was being done.
And you've referenced a couple of times this model, this four directions of influence model. So before we get into further examples of what it looks like in action, why don't you describe the model to us, and then we'll look to some examples for it.
Absolutely. And as you know, in our book, I Need to Effing Talk to You, The Art of Navigating Difficult Workplace Conversations, we talk about the four directions of influence in the book. And to use the example that we have in here, which was created by, my friend and colleague, Fergus Lawson, this was his sort of brainchild that he came up with, as long as the sort of competency framework to go with it, is if you imagine ourselves, and we perhaps ask our listeners to close their eyes momentarily, as long as they're not driving, of course, and just think about this. Imagine that you're in the center of a circle. And if you imagine an arrow going up from you to your manager or your boss, okay, and then if you imagine an arrow coming down from you to your employees or your team members, that would be a traditional command and control type structure. Fairly mechanistic. Most of us will probably have been in some sort of organizational structure that is like that, even if we don't use the term command and control, but we will have been in that type of hierarchy. If we add to that then two additional arrows, one coming out to our right, which is going to outside groups. So people are outside of our organization. So this could be partner organizations, it could be clients, it could be suppliers, it could be community groups, as it was with the police. And then if we look at the arrow on the left-hand side, we're talking about our peers. So these are people at the same level of us. Perhaps they have the same job title or similar job title. They work within our organization, but they don't work within our line management chain. So there's somebody that maybe manages another department, or they head up another store, and we're a store manager of one store and they're a store manager of another store. So again, we don't have a natural line of authority for those people that are in the organization but don't work for us, but also those people that are outside the organization who work for someone else or are a community member. It's not, we can't use leverage the same approach.
Right, right. And so in going back to your example of the some of those internal areas that they have to influence. So in the Scotland Yard example, what were some of those internal influences? Are these other borough commanders that they're trying to influence, or?
Yeah. So you could be looking at, if I was the borough commander for, say, Camden, then I'm also going to be having to work with other borough commanders from other boroughs, perhaps those that border on my borough, particularly when we're looking about resourcing or joint operations. We're also going to be talking about people with dealing with organised crime or undercover work or anti-terrorism or fraud or the vice. Any of those sort of other areas of the police would equally have responsibilities, and they might be at a similar level to us, but perhaps their responsibilities cuts across boroughs. So, anti-terrorism or organised crime is going to be thinking about that as a city as a whole, not just the particular area that I have responsibility, whereas I'm more responsible for perhaps the day-to-day policing in that area. So there will be some cutting across of responsibilities. And also, of course, as again, sounds self-evident, a crime doesn't restrict itself to a particular geographic area. You know, somebody isn't...
You're kidding.
Criminals
don't just stop at the edge of Camden and go, as if they're hitting an invisible wall.
As if we hadn't...
I have seen Peaky Blinders, and I know that these criminal groups divide the city up into quadrants and they stick within their own regions and within their own ethnic groups. I've seen that.
Yeah, so I think we got two things there. One is we might have different gangs of people and different groups who have control over certain areas, but those areas don't necessarily these effing people, you see, they don't just combine and say, I'll tell you what, Metropolitan Police, what is your organizational structure in terms of geographic area? We will organize our gangs so that we have the corresponding geographical structure, so that if you need to arrest, in the Peaky Blinders example, which is obviously up in Birmingham, but one of that, we can neatly say that this borough commander can actually take emphasis over this particular gang. Now, if you're lucky, yeah, it's one gang that's within one particular postcode, often they're postcode or organised. But some gangs are going to be across more than one borough, and of course you are going to have... crime doesn't stop. They don't sort of get to the bank and go, oh, we better not go in there and do anything because that's not our area, it's somebody else's. And certainly, as people will appreciate, with most criminals, the last people that they are interested in where they get permission from is the police. They might be worried about other gangs, but they're not going to be too worried about whether the police like it or don't like it. So,
let's bring this back to the business example. All joking aside, there's in a similar way in the real world, in the business world. Sorry, there's a we can see too that like the way that your company divvies up geographical areas or the way in which your company apportions tasks is not the same as the way your supplier divvies up the region or divvies up tasks or divvies up responsibilities. So I think maybe the example here is that in the same way that you can't speak the same command and control to as you would speak to your employees as you would with, say, your external peers or your suppliers or your consultants, there's also kind of understanding that your consultants might view the world in a different way. They might have cut the pie into a different shape. And so you need to kind of translate, the way in which you've divided, quote, the world, or the way in which you've divided the process. You also kind of need to match the way that they've divided the process, which might be completely different from yours. So Russell, in your business experience, like what's an example of that, just so I can wrap my head around that?
Well, typically where that comes down to is perhaps when you're looking at suppliers or contractors, where the model that they use for how they perhaps allocate their work or is going to be slightly different to the way that you do it. And some of that can be over terminology, how they term. Obviously, in industries, there tends to be an industry, a terminology that's common amongst many different firms. But unless you are their only client, the chances are they haven't tailored everything they do just for you. So they will have their own way of doing things that is going to prove to be efficient and effective for them and bring them a good profit in the same way that you do. So they might be structured slightly differently. They may have slightly different responsibilities for people, even though we might have the same job title, but our jobs may be slightly different. So that could be one element there when we're looking at contractors and suppliers, but also if we're working with partner agencies. So again, if we think about perhaps the nonprofit arena, which you've worked in a lot, Ken, that you might have one nonprofit that is focused on, let's say, mental health, but they're going to be working with other nonprofits that could be on mental health for teenagers or mental health for seniors. So again, they're doing similar work, but maybe not exactly the same as you are and exactly the same way, or may have a different model that they use to the one that you use. Perhaps they provide sheltered accommodation for people and you don't. You do in the community. So again, there's slightly different approaches require us to, one, understand the different approach that our partner agencies have, but also being able to speak their language. And the third thing is remember that they don't work for you. So even if you think you'd be much better if you guys did it this way, you can't make them do that because they don't work for you. You've got to persuade them. And I think that was one of the key elements that came out from the Borough Commander development model was this concept around being able to influence people.
And you use the phrase there that you need to persuade people rather than simply order people to do something, right? So so what tools did you give the borough commanders in order to give them that framework other than this this model that you just described with the up and down axis, vertical and the horizontal axis? What other models or what other framework did you give them to be able to work?
Yeah, so they were working on a competency framework and also a series of development activities that would help them to be better attuned to doing that. And I think when we have Fergus as our guest, I think that would be a really good topic for us to drill down in with him because obviously of his specific involvement. Before and after I left, I sort of got parachuted in for a point in the middle to assist. So without stealing some of his thunder, I think we could leave some of that for the conversation with him. But the challenge being, and another challenge for our borough commanders, was getting to, again, they intellectually understood this, but it was, again, getting into that habit because, as we probably all know listening here, we can know something is the case and that makes logical sense, but actually seeing it in practice and doing it as a matter of course can be a different thing, you know. We might know that it's good. Yeah, perhaps we shouldn't smoke tobacco because it's bad for us. But to actually stop smoking tobacco if you're a smoker is incredibly difficult to break those habits. And that's one of the things that they were finding a challenge, because what made them to be successful within the police structure wasn't necessarily the same skill set that they needed to be successful dealing with people outside the police structure. But they still had to be good at working within the police structure because that's how they worked in the rest of the time. So they were having to flex their style, really, to be able to demonstrate, you know, more than one approach, not just it being situational, but just a different culture that they were having to work with, and maybe being able to work with, let's say, you know, 3, 4, 5 different types of organizational culture at any moment in time that they could do within the same day.
And being able to put on those different hats and being able to recognize that they were working within different structures.
Yeah. Which again, it sort of sounds obvious, but then when you've done in your culture work that you do with your clients, having to switch between that often at sort of quick pace, and it could be I'm expecting X, but I get Y. So having to be able to flex that approach is quite a skill to be able to develop, particularly if you're more comfortable working in one or two settings and then find yourself having to work in others. So it really was a change in mindset adjustment and then a changing of habits.
And I think a lot of people can find that a lot of our listeners who might work within larger corporations or organizations that have different departments or divisions and that can be increasingly heavily siloed will have encountered this. Like I know for an example that comes to my mind was working within a department and then needing to post something. So I needed to access the marketing department, marketing communications department. So I'm working on my timeline and then I send them, here's the press release. Here's the comments I want turned into a press release to be released the day after tomorrow. And they'll look at that and go, great, we can get to that next week. Because they've got something else on their timeline. Now I might come back to them and say, well, it's got to be done by Thursday. And their response might be, can't be done by Thursday. My boss has me doing other things. You are not my boss. I don't have to listen to you. I can do it next week. Kind of a thing. So there's no way that I can order the marketing and communications department to work on my press release now. Their response traditionally is, well, poor planning on your department does not equate to an emergency on mine, right? But if I were to approach that same conversation in terms of like as a persuasive conversation, the way that you've described with this double access model, with if I think of them not as they're not in my command and control, can I influence them? Can I make a request? Can I ask them for assistance as a partner? Hey, we have this challenge that is for the greater good of the larger purpose of the organization. How can we work together to achieve this? Is a very different conversation than you need to do this by Thursday and no, I won't.
Absolutely. And that's a good example, Ken. I mean, and then being able to flex that again and come in that you finish that meeting and then go back into a meeting where you're expected to have asserted a more authoritarian approach. And then again, you know, the meeting this afternoon, you've got to go back in and flex your approach again. So I think the challenge is that whilst many of us may have to be able to adapt to how we work at various points in time with different groups of people, I think the challenge for these folks was that there was such a big shift, and it was also that this could be changing at any point. And again, you know, we're talking back 20 years when it wasn't as familiar to have to do that. I think if you went to any police service now and asked them, they would be much more attuned to that type of approach because it's how policing has changed over the last 20, 25 years from where it was before.
At the same time, I have a lot of empathy for that situation 20 years ago. I mean, I'm reminded of the phrase that if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. So if all of your training for 30 years, as you've risen up the ranks, has been about a command and control structure, then you have a hammer. And everything looks like a nail. And when you move outside of the policing organization into this newfangled turn of the millennia world that the post the Stephen Lawrence inquiry that you mentioned, then suddenly you're trying to apply a hammer to when you should be using a screwdriver, right? For instance, or a wrench or whatever other metaphor we might like to use.
Exactly. And you're also under intense political scrutiny and media scrutiny. So they're fairly senior police officers. You're likely to be in front of the media fairly regularly and having to answer not just to senior police officers, but also local and national politicians, to which everybody's looking at this and everyone is waiting for you in some ways. And there are some who are looking for you to fall flat on your face so they can say, oh, look, see, we told you they weren't up to do it. So there's another layer to that. I think if we're not somebody that works in the public eye, regularly, and most of us don't. We work in our own organization or as consultants working with different organizations, but we haven't got that scrutiny of everything that we do, everything we say, you know, every press conference we give. There are going to be people scrolling through it line by line to find out where we have, you know, used the wrong phrase, or we didn't come across empathetic enough, or we came across as too soft and not too hard enough. So everything is being analysed. And I think that's, it was one of the things I think has come up on our previous podcast with people. I think it was with Peter Rumpel when he's talking about actors. And I think the Leonardo DiCaprio example was one, when everybody is watching everything that he said and did when he was on set. And I think it was similar with these individuals, with a high profile that everybody is looking at them, and you better get this right, otherwise, one, you won't have a job, and secondly, we're looking, there are a certain section of society that is looking to immediately get the police if they're seen to make a misstep or they do something wrong, then you know you're gonna be held under the media microscope for it. So Yeah, the pressure to get it right for them was pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. You know, I'm also seeing how in the book we overlaid this with another model called the social contracting model, which I think is kind of useful here in the sense that even within your command and control structure, as organizations become increasingly flat and as leaders become increasingly less authoritarian and more cooperative, we often run into a confusion of the way in which these conversations happen. And the social contracting model that we described briefly in that section of the book is useful because you have to, as a leader, we need to be increasingly mindful of the language we use and of how we approach these conversations. And the book outlines three different kinds of conversations. You can be making a statement, you can be making a request, or you can be giving a command. And it is important for a leader to distinguish between these things. If you're making a statement, that's something along the lines of "this should get done," but you're not assigning with that statement, you're not assigning any one of your team members to actually do it, right? But what often happens is that a leader might say, "this should get done," and then would expect that their team would simply pick up the hint and go about doing it. But, you know, a team member could just as rightfully push back with, "well, I didn't do it because it's not my job description," or "I didn't do it because you didn't ask me, you didn't assign me to it." Right. Similarly, we've also seen some leaders who are new into their position of authority and who aren't quite comfortably wearing that overcoat yet, or who feel as if it's an ill-fitting jacket in some way, aren't quite yet comfortable giving a command. And so they may approach their team members and they may think they're giving a command, but in fact, they're actually giving a request. So this is the type of conversation that unfolds where a leader can come to one of their team members and say, "would you please possibly consider doing this assignment? It would be great if you could do it for tomorrow sometime before noon." Now, the leader might think that that's a command, but you, the listeners, can probably assume where I'm going with this, that, you know, it's just as easy for the employee to think, "well, sorry, I thought it was optional," right? Or, you know, I had other things that came up, so I wasn't able to get it done for noon. You didn't say it was important that I got it done for noon.
That's very true. Yeah.
And so I think it's important then too, like in addition to the XY axis that we've described, that you also understand kind of not only where you are in that on that axis and where your employees are on that axis, but then that your language and the type of question, command, or control, or question, command, or request that you're making is clearly delineated.
For sure. And I think if we just go back to that policing example, when we talked about, you know, community groups, the other thing to think about there is, of course, you're assuming there that a community group means it's one voice. And of course, as we've seen in more recent times, it's not. It's numerous voices. And one of the challenges is who speaks for this particular group? Or is it multiple people? Who might have multiple objectives, or some of them may not even be synchronized. They could just be completely competing against each other. So we've seen in parts of the states, you know, you can have those that are wanting the police defunded and want less policing, those that want more policing, those that want different policing, those that want different policing for certain things but not for other things, and at different times and in different circumstances. So all of that is competing against, you know, just in one of those dynamics when we're looking at those four dimensions. And it would be not dissimilar necessarily in the other dimensions as well, that you're being asked to do, you know, many competing priorities and competing requirements, and you're expected to be able to identify very quickly between those individuals as to how I need to respond to each of those individual people at any given point in time, but still maintaining some consistency so that I'm not just some complete scatterbrain that people say, "well, every time I meet him, he seems to be a different person," you know. So It's a juggling act, I think, and I think that people will recognise that in business as well. As things become more sophisticated in terms of when we're dealing with different groups of people in our business, they, you know, we've not just got suppliers, isn't just one group. It's a series of several different groups of people. Employees are a series of seven different groups of people. And as we start to understand that, the challenge for any leader is to be able to flex multiple styles that could be different with different people on different days for different reasons. And I suppose it's just, you know, it's more complex than perhaps it even looks when we try and simplify it with our models to make it easier to understand. Then we overlay the complexity of the reality, and it, like the simplistic part helps people to be able to translate it. But it's a tough situation, I think, for a lot of leaders to be in.
And, you know, I'd love to hear from our listeners about some examples of some of the tough situations that they've been in where they've had to exert influence outside of the traditional command and control structure, what that looked like for them, and what strategies worked for them. You said earlier, Russell, when you were describing the program that you and Fergus did at Scotland Yard, that you had different borough commanders offering advice. This worked for me. Why don't you try it in your borough? So maybe we can invite our listeners to apply the same sense of generosity and same sense of community spirit. Why don't you send us an email of an example of what that was like for you? And then on a future episode, when we revisit this topic, we can share some of those stories. And what email address should they direct these towards, Russell?
And yeah, best to send it to info@ineedtoeffingtalktoyou.com. You can visit their website and fill it in there and send it off to us. That would be great to see. It'd be good to see some different examples that people have had of how it, this type of, you know, flexing of style based upon internal and external communications affects their business. I think that would be useful to share that with other listeners. So please give us your examples. And as Ken says, we'll revisit this in a later podcast and share them with you.
And speaking of revisiting this topic in future podcasts, you had said you'd hinted that we might have an interview with Fergus coming up. So have you organized that already? And we're looking forward to that.
It is. He's coming up. So hopefully we'll be interviewing in a couple of weeks' time. So in the next one or two podcast episodes, we will be interviewing a proper effing guest in Fergus Lawson. And he'll be talking about, no doubt, some of his work at the Metropolitan Police, but also broader into his work a lot in the public sector, London Ambulance Service, National Health Service Trusts, and also his work in France, as he now lives in France. So working with French organisations as well, and some of the different organisational challenges there. So looking forward to that conversation with him, and that'll build upon a number of the things that we've talked about in this episode.
Oh, I'll look forward to hearing that and meeting with him as well. After this episode, and after having heard about it for years and read about it and written about it in the book, I'll look forward to being able to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So thanks very much for joining us today, Russell. It's been a pleasure having you as a guest on this episode. So thank you for putting on your guest hat. Thank you to you, our listeners, as always, for joining us today. You can, of course, subscribe to the podcast by your podcast provider of choice so that you can be alerted to upcoming episodes as they are released. And we look forward to hosting you again in the future. Until the next effing time, we look forward to effing talking to you again.
Okay, thanks, everyone. Bye.